This week on Vaticano, explore the rich history of the venerable English college in Rome and its many martyrs. On the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, discover the Sanctuary of Tre Fontane and the message of the Madonna of Revelation. Finally, journey to the Holy House of Loreto in Italy. Vaticano starts now. The Vatican is preparing for Christmas. The nativity scene in St. Peter's Square and the traditional huge Christmas tree were inaugurated on December the 7th. Each year, the Pope invites an Italian town to bring together its artisans to create a nativity scene typical of the region. Last year, it was the turn of Greccio, where St. Francis of Assisi organized the first ever live nativity scene in history. This year, the nativity scene comes from the seaside town of Grado, located between Venice and Trieste. The nativity will be set amidst the characteristic casoni, or fishermen's huts, of the Grado Lagoon. Visitors will also be able to see the small traditional boats typical of the island.
And we wanted to recreate here, in St. Peter's Square, the Grado Lagoon itself. The nativity scene belongs to the community of Grado, because I involved local collaborators. I brought together 40 people to create this great masterpiece, because it truly is remarkable.
The nativity scene measures 30 meters in length and 14 meters in width. These dimensions posed a challenge for the builders, who had to transport it from Grado to the Vatican, over 600 kilometers away.
We designed a project in such a way that the elements could be assembled, let's say like Legos, practically in pieces. The outer edge itself, with the water rays, consists of 102 foam pieces. A lining goes inside, and these essentially forms the Grado Lagoon.
Questo costituisce la Laguna di Grado.
We're the first to bring water to St. Peter's Square, the architect proudly remarked. Additionally, the floating nativity scene features other unique elements that make it very special. By building it on a water base, it will become a new attraction for the seagulls of St. Peter's Square. To protect it, the builders have installed ultrasonic devices to deter the seagulls. In addition, the craftsmen wanted to completely recreate the atmosphere of the lagoon at the Vatican, so they set about printing the lagoon's birds in 3D.
We wanted to recreate not only the static elements within the lagoon, but also to bring in the wildlife of the lagoon, the plants of the lagoon.
In 2016, they presented the project to the Vatican through the parish of Grado. Now, almost 8 years later, the builders eagerly await the inauguration of their work in St. Peter's Square.
Era un sogno mio.
It was my dream, which started by chance. And after a few years, we made it here. It will be the dream of everyone in Grado.
Quelli di Grado.
Pope Francis has profoundly shaped the future of the Catholic Church, creating 142 cardinals from 70 countries across 9 consistories since his election in 2013. On December the 7th, he held his 10th consistory, elevating 21 new cardinals and emphasizing the Church's global diversity. Of these, 18 are under 80 and eligible to vote in a future conclave to elect the next pope.
Ognuno di noi può ricordare voci e volti concreti.
5 Italians have been chosen by Pope Francis to become cardinals at the upcoming consistory. 4 of them are under 80, meaning they'll be eligible to vote in the next papal conclave. Here's a brief look at each. Archbishop Roberto Repoli of Turin is 57 years old. He took part in both sessions of the Global Synod on Synodality in 2023 and 2024. He also joined the Theological Pastoral Forums organized by the Synod of Bishops to reflect on the Church's missionary work. Archbishop Baldassare Reina, at 54, is the youngest cardinal being elevated to cardinal. This year, Pope Francis appointed him Vicar General for the Diocese of Rome. Archpriest of the Basilica of St. John Lateran, titular Bishop of Acque di Mauritania, Apostolic Administrator of Ostia, and Grand Chancellor of the Pontifical Lateran University. Father Fabio Baggio, a member of the Scalabrinians, is the only one in this group from a religious congregation. He will become titular Archbishop of Arusi and has worked at the Vatican's Dicastery for Promoting Integral Human Development since 2017. Archbishop Domenico Battaglia of Naples is well known for his care for the poor. During his priesthood, he spent over 20 years running a drug rehabilitation center in Calabria. Finally, Archbishop Angelo Acerbi, at 99, will be the oldest member of the College of Cardinals. He has served as bishop for 50 years and spent 40 of those in the Vatican's diplomatic service. After this consistory, the College of Cardinals includes 141 electors, with nearly 80%, 111 in total, appointed by Pope Francis, barring any unexpected changes.
In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancto. Amen.
Hello and welcome to this week's Vaticano Updates, the most important news from the Holy Father and the Vatican. Pope Francis affirmed that the final document of the Synod on Synodality is now part of the Church's ordinary magisterium and must be implemented by dioceses and local churches. Highlighting its importance, the pontiff described it as the authentic teaching of the Bishop of Rome. The document calls for structural reforms, including greater participation of lay people and women in the Church. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Pope Francis at the Vatican. While the Holy See did not disclose details of the audience, the State Department reported that discussions centered on conflicts in the Middle East and Ukraine as part of Blinken's European diplomatic tour. Key topics included the recently announced Israel-Lebanon ceasefire and efforts to mitigate the humanitarian impact of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Pope Francis has written to Catholics in Nicaragua, expressing his closeness, affection, and constant prayers to the Virgin Mary, asking for her comfort amid the persecution of faith under President Daniel Ortega's regime. The Holy Father reaffirmed his deep love for the Nicaraguan people and encouraged them with these words: "Be assured that faith and hope work miracles." Chinese has been added as the 9th official language at papal general audiences, expanding the weekly event's multilingual reach. Key portions, including scripture readings, papal address summaries, and greetings, are now delivered in Mandarin alongside Italian, English, French, German, Spanish, Portuguese, Polish, and Arabic. Mandarin, the world's most spoken language, boasts nearly 1 billion speakers, surpassing Spanish and English. Pope Francis has invited Orthodox leaders to jointly celebrate the 1,700th anniversary of the First Council of Nicaea in 2025. As proposed in a letter to Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople. While praising the renewed fraternity fostered since Vatican II, the Pope emphasized that full communion, including sharing the one Eucharistic chalice, remains an unfulfilled aspiration. He also announced plans to visit Turkey for the anniversary. Thank you so much for watching this week's Vaticano Updates. In Rome, Andreas Tonhauser for EWTN Vaticano.
In a few moments, we'll be back with a special look at the Venerable English College in Rome.
The situation in England was grave for Catholics. The Protestant Reformation, which we think of now very much as an historical fact, was a live one for them. And particularly for those who would celebrate Mass for priests, and for those who would seek to aid them in their mission, it became a question of life and death. And because of that, preparation for priestly ministry had to take place on the continent.
Nestled in the heart of Rome, the Venerable English College has been forming men to the priesthood since the English Reformation. An extremely dangerous time for Catholics.
The young men coming from England and Wales to study here were very conscious of the difficulties back home. Their hearts were on fire, but they knew the dangers as well. They knew the risks. They knew that to be caught as a Catholic priest, you would have been probably tortured, tried, and then executed as a traitor.
After their ordinations, the many young priests would indeed return to England and Wales to lead a secretive existence in constant danger of betrayal, arrest, and execution, which was the fate of the English college's first martyr, St. Ralph Sherwin, on December 1, 1581. Over the next 100 years, 44 former students were martyred, most by being hung, drawn, and quartered, the brutal execution method of the day.
It is amazing history, the heroism of the martyrs, studying in these circumstances, going home on mission. But it's so relevant to today as well, because today we need missionary priests. The cultures are not always welcoming to the gospel and to the Christian message. So to be able to share your faith in a loving way, but to have the courage and also the creativity you need to share that faith in new and difficult circumstances, the martyrs are such a model for that.
Originally founded for seminarians returning to England and Wales, the college today welcomes students from Scandinavia, Australia, Croatia, and beyond.
Today, things are a little bit different, but we go home, we're all going home to some kind of hostile environment, you know, and we will encounter hostility in different ways. So, I mean, to know that they were willing to do what they did really is an inspiration, I think, for us.
Though generations apart, seminarians past and present share not only the same vocation and mission, but also a unique connection through the Liber Ruber, the Red Book. Since 1579, all students have signed the missionary oath in the Liber Ruber, which to this day records the names and details of every student in the college. The first to sign it was St. Ralph Sherwin himself, who swore to return to England, hodie quam cras, today rather than tomorrow.
In the pages of that book are countless generations of priests, including our martyr saints, who have spent their lives in the service of God's church. And I think there's something deeply formative about that, because they realize very quickly that the book that they're signing was signed by a person just like them, by often a young man who came to this college not only with the certainty of faith and the strength and the grace that that brings, but also with their own questions and worries and anxieties.
On St. George's Day, the day when St. Ralph Sherwin signed the book, in 1579, Carling will sign the Liber Ruber, along with the four other first-year seminarians, hopefully with that same zeal as the martyrs, he shared, and that same desire to take the gospel back to our own countries.
We no longer take quite the same oath, but we make that same implicit promise when we sign this book that if ordained, we will return to our home countries to be priests.
Another reminder of their mission is the martyrs' picture in the chapel. Painted in 1580, it depicts the Holy Trinity with the blood of Jesus igniting the earth. The two English martyrs and patrons of the college, St. Thomas of Canterbury and St. Edmund, King of East Anglia, can be seen on the left and the right, pointing towards a gate.
This is the Flaminian Gate, which represents the road going north. So it's the road home. So our two saints are saying to us and to everyone today who's in the church, your destiny, your vocation, is not to stay in Rome forever. It's to remember that you're here for a purpose. It's to go home. It's to be on mission. It's to take the good news of Jesus. It's to take your experience of being here in Rome back home to those who need to hear the gospel.
The Roman sanctuary of Tre Fontane, a place of prayer and conversion, today stands as a symbol of hope in a world devastated by wars and suffering. François Vane, who currently serves as the Director of Communications for the Grand Magisterium of the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre of Jerusalem, has recently published a book, The Virgin of Revelation, The Message of Tre Fontane, exploring the history and significance of this sanctuary, hidden in the southern part of the Eternal City, amidst a lush green setting surrounding a grotto where the Virgin appeared in 1947.
François, thank you so much for being with us this morning to talk about your new book. I'd like to begin by going back to the past, to the origins of the event. Where did the desire to explore and recount this story of Tre Fontane come from?
Let's say I first encountered Tre Fontane when I was 13 years old, in 1975. It was the Holy Year, and at that time, I was living in Algeria. With the Diocese of Algiers, we had come to Rome for the grand event of the Holy Year. When I better understood who Bruno Cornacchiola was, a married man and father who wanted to kill Pope Pius XII because he was very sectarian and fanatical, I tried to learn more. When we returned from Spain, where we had fought in the Civil War and killed many people, including priests, he brought back the knife with which he intended to kill Pope Pius XII, whom he considered a tyrant. He waged war against all Marian dogmas, particularly the Immaculate Conception, aiming to show that the Catholic Church was the synagogue of Satan. When he decided to go to Tre Fontane, a place he knew from childhood, he went with his three children to prepare his lecture against Marian dogmas, which he was to deliver the next day in a Roman square. The children saw Mary first. He thought they were playing a prank on him. Then he saw her too. Mary spoke to him. The children saw her, but didn't hear the message. After that, he went home, knelt before his wife to ask for forgiveness. She believed him, because usually she was the one kneeling, asking him to stop beating her. Now, seeing him kneel before her, she believed something had truly happened.
While this apparition is less well known than others like Lourdes or Fatima, how can it enrich and deepen our faith today in these modern times?
Well, I see two main points to respond to your question. First, the apparition has not been officially recognized by the Church in the same way as Lourdes or Fatima, for example. This lack of official recognition has made the site less known. However, at the same time, it has been recognized in a de facto sense. For instance, John Paul II was very attached to the apparition at Tre Fontane. He authorized public worship there and gave the sanctuary its official name, the Sanctuary of Our Lady of Revelation. So there is a kind of implicit recognition that allows people to visit Tre Fontane, pray there, and engage with its message. Secondly, while the apparition hasn't received the same formal recognition as Lourdes or Fatima, it holds significant value. Pope Pius XII was deeply moved by what Bruno Cornacchiola conveyed to him. Cornacchiola shared the details of the apparition, particularly its message, which supported the Pope's intuition to proclaim the dogma of the Assumption. Pope Pius XII saw Tre Fontane as a confirmation of this institution, and 3 years later, on November 1st, 1950, he proclaimed the dogma of the Assumption on All Saints' Day. In 1957, amidst the Cold War's beginnings following World War II, the Virgin at Tre Fontane warned of a Third World War, a conflict that would be worse than the Second. This warning came as the Cold War, with its two opposing blocs, began to unfold, much like what we are experiencing today. Pope Pius XII saw the urgency of turning the woman clothed with the sun, the Virgin of the Apocalypse. The Virgin of the Revelation of Tre Fontane is the Virgin of the Apocalypse, and she calls us to turn to her because she alone can save us from the dragon and planetary destruction. John Paul II said that Tre Fontane continues the message of Fatima, reminding us that at the end of time, her Immaculate Heart will prevail.
Parce qu'elle vient nous dire qu'à la fin, son cœur immaculé triomphera.
François, thank you so much for writing this very, very important book. We are so happy to share it with the public. Thank you.
Merci.
We'll be back after a short break with a short visit to the Holy House of Loreto. Pontifical Sanctuary of the Holy House, perched on the hilltop town of Loreto in central Italy, is one of the most famous and precious Marian shrines in the world. It attracts millions of pilgrims every year, and numerous miracles and conversions are continuously recorded.
They come from all parts of Europe, but also from the Americas, from Africa, Asia, Japan, and China. We have tourist guides in 13 languages so that we can meet the various requests. So it's a very international shrine of devotion to the Mother of God and to the mystery that is revealed in the House of Mary.
Giuseppe Santarelli, a Capuchin priest who is a living symbol of this place and has been working here for over 40 years, knows very well that people visit this sanctuary enclosed in a beautiful Renaissance basilica because of its remarkable history and sacred significance.
This is the House of Mary, where she lived and where she received the Annunciation. And in this sense, it is also the home of the mystery of the Incarnation. For this reason, it is one of the greatest Marian shrines in the world due to its relic and its antiquity.
For centuries, numerous artistic depictions fueled the belief that angels miraculously carried the Holy House from Nazareth to Loreto in 1294. Others held that the Holy House was brought to Italy at the end of the Crusades, like many other relics from the Holy Land. In fact, in 1900, a priest found records in the Vatican archives, indicating that a Byzantine Greek family named Angelos, which translates to angels in English, rescued Mary's home during the Muslim conquest of 1291.
Ci sono indicazioni documentali che...
There is a documentary evidence that indicates the house was transported to this location by sea through human initiative, rather than by the mystery of angels. However, the angels signify a special protection from God who wishes to preserve this house, which commemorates the mystery of the Incarnation, and thus it is a most precious relic.
Regardless of how the house arrived to Italy, there's little doubt that its walls are those of the Grotto of the Annunciation in Nazareth. Studies have shown that the stones making up the walls are not native to its current location and were not cut according to the local Italian methods. The most convincing evidence is the discovery of ancient Christian and Marian graffiti markings on the Loreto walls, similar to those in ancient Judeo-Christian churches in Palestine. The relic of the Holy House is covered by the marble ornamentation that is one of the highest expressions of 16th century sculpture for its artistic quality and the size of design, 610 square meters of masterpiece. The four gates of the Holy House were made with the chains of the Christian slaves with which they were bound during the Battle of Lepanto against the Turks in 1571. Christian soldiers turned to the Lady of Loreto for her protection. And after the victory, they brought their chains to the shrine. Inside the basilica, many national chapels spread the artistic beauty around. Among them, the American chapel with a lot of historic characters like presidents or astronauts can be seen. Thousands of Americans come to pray here at Our Lady of Loreto.
On the right wall of the chapel, there is a depiction of the Virgin Mary. Saint of aviation because Our Lady of Loreto in 1920 was proclaimed the patron of aviation by Benedict XV, and thus regarded as a patron saint of air travelers by all Catholics around the world.
Many saints and popes have visited the shrine. Saint John Paul II called the Holy House of Loreto the true Marian heart of Christianity. Following in his footsteps, Pope Francis visited Loreto on the Solemnity of the Annunciation in 2019. He signed the post-synodal apostolic exhortation, Christus Vivit, within the Holy House, anchoring the Church's message to youth in this sacred site. This act underscored that the future of the church is deeply rooted in Mary's example and her yes to the Lord.